counsel.
Please, Court, my name is Josh Rose for the plaintiff's appellants. This is a class and an age discrimination action. It was certified under Rule 23. It's a federal employer, so the operative statute is 633A of the Age Act rather than 623, which applies to private employers. The basic question we have on this appeal, Your Honors, is whether the decision that was made in October of 2004 to move headcount from specialist positions and resolutions, where there was very little work, to generalist positions that were to be filled with trainees over the subsequent 4 years, is a decision that is a personnel action that needs to be free of discrimination under 633A of the Age Act. The court below did not accept our statistics. The statistics show overwhelmingly, and they were unrebutted, that there was a significant age impact in the people who were affected by the October 2004 decision. The court below limited the analysis to a RIF that was the final stage of the downsizing portion of the plan that was announced in 2004. It was far from the entire plan. Every other court that has addressed this question has held the plaintiffs may, in fact, introduce statistics and otherwise show evidence to show that a plan is undertaken for discriminatory reasons. This is an intentional discrimination case. We believe that the evidence is overwhelming, that the plan was undertaken in October 2004 for the purpose of getting rid of the older employees and eventually replacing them with the trainees. The plan was clever because rather than take the experienced people who are high performers and have been with the agency a long time and offer them retraining, offer them RIF rights, offer them the ability to bump, the headcount was subtracted from the agency temporarily and it was put back into a training program, and the 500 positions were filled over the course of 4 years at 120 positions a year.
Is it central to your argument on appeal that the trial court failed to use the Teamster analysis as opposed to McDonnell Douglas?
We believe that statistics show intentional discrimination. The Teamster analysis is for using statistics to show a pattern of practice.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it were a McDonnell Douglas case, though, the class question would have to come first before the individual questions under the Supreme Court case of Cooper versus Federal Reserve.
Did you preserve the objection to the non-use of the Teamster analysis in the court below?
Yes, Your Honor. There's several
What's
ways.
Your best record of that?
Well, there's a Woodruff case in this circuit provides a standard. It says it has to be in the complaint. Here it was pattern of practice was alleged in the complaint. It also, Teamsters was cited, pattern of practice was on the first pages of the summary judgment briefs. And furthermore,
did you argue it in the summary judgment briefs or did you simply allude to it?
Now,
I understand that inclusion in the complaint is necessary. I'm not necessarily sure it's sufficient. Did you argue the Teamster?
We argued that a case called Adams versus Ameritech out of the Seventh Circuit is controlling. Adams was decided on a hybrid of Teamsters and disparate impact.
And where do I look in the joint appendix to find that Adams analysis?
It's all over the supplemental appendix, Your Honor. Adams was the same case in our list of cases. If you look at the supplemental appendix, page 66, that's the allusion to Adams. You can see it was cited all over the brief. It's Passim.
Which is not something that we like. Passim is a signal that we actually have stated we do not like used because it does not help us find things.
Well,
page 66 of your supplemental appendix is a table of contents.
It's the table of, I'm just illustrating that the case was cited all over that brief.
Well, actually, you're not yet. You haven't, the table of contents in the first place, I don't think, mentions it. And 68 is the page.
Is where Adams is shown to be cited all over the brief.
It's shown to be Passim. Is there some place it's actually cited as opposed to called a possum?
We did rely on the Adams case below. We rely on it here.
Well, before you can rely on it here, you have to rely on it below. I mean, not necessarily literally.
Look at the supplemental appendix, page 97, for example, Your Honor. Page 97 of the supplemental appendix is page 25 of that brief, which is one of the summary judgment briefs. It quotes extensively from Adams on that page. It goes on to discuss that the Hen-Adams standard applies.
That language on 97 doesn't seem to be referring to the Teamster standard. That seems to be referring to whether this is an adverse action, which, of course, is an issue in the case. But it doesn't seem to be dealing with the, it seemed to me that one of your biggest argument, perhaps on appeal, is that the case should have been subjected to a Teamster review. And the defense seemed to be that you didn't preserve that below. I don't think I'm reading things into this that aren't here, but isn't it fundamental to your argument that the court erred in not employing a Teamster review?
Well, we Teamsters, the point is that in a class case, Teamsters is a prime example of a class discrimination case where there's first a decision on the pattern of practice, the class-wide question. Cooper is actually the Supreme Court case where they said that the class issue is separate from the individual issue because the individuals can then go and bring their own case after the class issue has been lost. And that's exactly what's happened here. The judge decided the class issue by excluding all these individuals, and he said that the constructive discharge was decided as a matter of law rather than looking at the individual circumstances of the constructive discharges. So, yes, the waiver argument under Woodruff, we have cited the complaint, which certainly said pattern of practice. I'll bring you the cites on the rebuttal, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I don't have them right here, but we certainly say that we raised it both in the complaint and in the summary judgment briefs in the form of the Adams argument and the Teamsters argument. Pattern of practice appears early in the summary judgment papers, and furthermore, the statistics to show intent to discriminate are the same whether they're under a pattern of practice or whether they're under a disparate impact. All that's different is that disparate impact, you don't have to show intent. It's the same numbers. It's the same evidence, which is the other portion of the Woodruff standard. The evidence was certainly in. The same report by Dr. Sieberhagen shows pattern of practice. It shows that this plan caused older people to leave the agency in much larger numbers than younger people. And the basic question is whether you count the people who took the buyout that was offered in May or whether you don't count those people.
And the people who took the buyout, you said they were older, correct? Tended to be older.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they also would tend to have a better sum offered to them because of their seniority, isn't that right?
Early retirement was an element of the buyout. The particular item you got if you took the buyout rather than waiting for the RIF was a half year's pay, which I believe was the same for everybody.
But the percentage was the same. The dollar amount was different.
Well, some people would pay more than others. Some are GS-12, some are GS-7s. That wasn't necessarily their age, though.
That's the point. It wasn't necessarily age, but seniority or rank in the general schedule.
Well, our position on that is that the affirmative defense that under Bazemore, or if this were a private action, you were under the safe harbor. If we read the safe harbor provision for early buyouts into the federal statute, where it doesn't appear, but even if you were under 623 and you had the safe harbor, it would still be an affirmative defense to show that the people should be excluded because they took it, you know, for their own decision rather than what the evidence actually shows, which is that they were threatened with job loss. We have people who were told explicitly, you will not survive this RIF. The guy sitting next to you, one of those two positions is going to be eliminated.
That's helpful information.
And Ms. Powers-Gray was told.
It's not making it involuntary. It's informing the decision.
Well, the question is whether putting her in that position in the first place, targeting her job for elimination, is discriminatory or not. This isn't a situation like in Bodner versus Simple.
Okay, but that's further back in the story, right?
It is the story, Your Honor.
It was the selection of, or I guess you're focusing on the selection of the positions rather than on communicating the probability that the job would be eliminated.
Well, the plan that was sent out in October 2004, which appears at 343 or thereabouts of the Joint Appendix, had specific tables saying if you're in the director's office or the receivership's office and you're in a grade 12 position or something, for example, Ms. Powers Gray, I believe, was in investigations and she was a GS 7. Well, you can see that 6 of the 8 GS 7s were going to be eliminated from that job. And what her boss told her was that the other guy who was left was a retired lieutenant colonel and he'd get veterans preference. Well, it turned out to be incorrect, but that's what she reasonably believed when she took the buyout. She believed he was incorrect on the veterans preference role because the guy was receiving a pension. But what she reasonably believed when she decided to take the buyout was that she was going to lose her job. Not that generally there were going to be some eliminations and that there was some risk of a RIF, which is the language Judge Urbina, the court below, uses. This wasn't a situation where there was merely a threat of a RIF. They knew that the positions were going to be eliminated. This was a tantamount to a RIF notice, such as we have in the Schmidt versus Frosch case, binding precedent in this circuit. That was a RIF situation in NASA. It wasn't in the FDIC, but otherwise it's on all fours.
So did you have evidence that the positions listed in the table for elimination were disproportionately held by older employees?
The evidence we have is that older employees disproportionately left, and there is no evidence that was offered by the defendant to show that anybody left whose position wasn't targeted. We have 33 declarations in the record of people saying the only reason I left is because I thought I was going to lose my job anyway. My position
this
was targeted.
Is this a disparate impact argument or is it a discrimination argument?
It's a pattern of practice argument, Your Honor. We're saying
it's a type of impact argument, isn't it?
It's adverse impact in the people who left. The bottom line of the whole multi-step process was that people over 50 left at about 150% the rate of people under 50. And
isn't the right universe, as you're complying with this chart, for your pattern of practice argument, the right universe, those who were targeted and whether they were disproportionately older?
Well, the evidence we put in was on the effect of the whole process on a pattern of practice theory, that what matters is who actually left, whether they left because they were threatened in the first place or whether they were finally fired in the RIF.
Who actually left is problematic because and you introduce, as you said, might be an affirmative defense, but it's not clear that you've made out your prima facie case if you haven't portrayed the targeted group as being disproportionately older. There are lots of reasons people might leave, right? But if the targeted group was disproportionately younger, none of those reasons would matter.
That's true, Your Honor, and the evidence we have is that of the 500 and some positions targeted, 230 some were targeted in the Division of Resolutions and Receiverships, which was 65% people over 50. It was by far the oldest part of the agency. And that what they decided to do in October, what they announced at the same time as the job cuts, was to hire a bunch of trainees over the course of the next 4 years. And the 150% adverse impact is before we even consider the new hires. That's just the people who left. The plan that was announced in October 2004 was to get rid of the incumbents who were older and to hire trainees to replace them. Many of the incumbents, they were all successful.
Well, I thought the trainees were not hired for DRR, and very few of them ended up there.
The agency could easily have taken the experienced good performers in DRR and said, we're going to offer you cross-training. You want to come to Washington? You want to come to DSC?
That,
we have these jobs.
That seems to me more relevant than what happened to the ones that they hired through the CEP.
Well, what
if they didn't, in other words, if they didn't, it's not that the ones in the CEP ended up in DRR. It's that the ones being riffed out of DRR may have been entitled to an opportunity to transfer within to a different silo.
Well, the headcount was moved, and it was moved in a way that those positions were not available for transfer at the time the people had to decide what to do. In fact, the recruiting for the CEP program started on the day after the RIF took effect. or the day before, I'm sorry.
What was the barrier to the transfer?
There were no jobs to transfer into. The jobs weren't created until later, until after the people had already been forced out of the agency.
The CEP people filled, you mean?
The CEP was filled at a rate of 120 jobs a year. Mm-hmm. The evidence is that continued over the course of the time from 2005 through 2009. Ms. Crosser testified they were hiring at that rate. They could easily have taken these experienced people who are already good performers and said, well, I'm going to give you an opportunity to retrain because we need people in this other area. Instead, they designed the program so that they would first eliminate people and then hire new ones. And that eliminated any opportunity to transfer. If I'm Ms. Powers Gray and I'm sitting here and I know that six of the eight people are going to be eliminated, I don't have anywhere to transfer to. I know I'm going to lose my job because my supervisor told me I'm going to lose my job. And I can decide to take a buyout, or I can decide to wait to get fired and not get the extra half year's pay. That's the decision we're looking at.
Were there criteria for being hired in the CEP that would have precluded someone who'd just been riffed from applying?
I believe they could have applied for the CEP, and we have some people who did try to apply for the CEP and weren't selected. But the basic discrimination that we are looking at is in targeting the jobs, as Your Honor pointed out, and the evidence we have that the jobs were targeted is the people who wound up leaving. We're all older. And we don't have any evidence in the record that anybody took the buyout whose job wasn't targeted. And if that would have been an affirmative defense, the defendant didn't introduce that evidence. It's not in the record. If that's got to be looked at, it should be looked at on remand.
You know, I know that you're not comfortable with the McDonnell-Douglas standard being the governing standard, but if it is, do you have any evidence of pretext and rebuttal to the government's bona fide business reason or non-discriminatory reasons for what?
Well, the court below held that the legitimate business reason was that there needed to be cuts in DRR. We've never contested that. There wasn't work in DRR at the time. We're not contesting the government's decision, the agency's decision to say we don't need resolution specialists anymore. We're going to create these jobs where they're cross-trained to be resolution specialists and bank examiners. What we're saying is we had a population of people who were already good at these kind of tasks, who'd already been working for the agency for 20 years or more. Instead of giving them the opportunity to transfer over, instead of taking that headcount and creating new jobs that they could move into, they took that headcount and took it away for a while so that the people's jobs would be ended. And then they inserted the headcount back in. It's a fire department. When there's a fire, when there's a bunch of bank failures, they need these people. There aren't, they don't.
I assume that response is to my question, but I'm not sure that it is. Is there evidence that you got your prima facie in, they got their pretext, their legitimate non-discriminatory reason in, and we normally would expect some evidence of pretext. Well, is there evidence that this is a pretext?
Well, the point is that the non-discriminatory reason doesn't address the discriminatory targeting. It addresses the decision to eliminate those jobs. We also have statements by the chairman that he prefers to have young people around him. He was asked in deposition, did you make those kind of statements? He said, yeah, I made those kind of statements all the time.
And he said he also referred to the value of experience a lot, too, didn't he?
He
said he preferred to have young people around him. He said he liked to have young people around him. He also liked to have experienced people around him.
He admitted to one comment that we asked him. He didn't admit to the other one, but it was an ageist comment. We also have evidence that the people designing the program back in October 2004 were asking how many people were old enough to retire at the time they designed the program. It's clear that the buyout portion was designed to encourage incumbents to leave. They used the retirement
Isn't that inherent in a buyout?
It is. And,
so is a buyout inherently discriminatory then?
If a buyout is done, as it was in the Henn case, where they say anybody can have an opportunity to buy out and then we're going to decide who to riff, mm-hmm. There are courts that have said that's okay. But this is more like the Adams case, where they said you're going to be fired if you don't take this buyout. It's like Downey on the individual level, except this was done on a class basis. They said these jobs are going to be cut. The people could see where they were going to fall out on the riff, and they could know that they were going to lose their job. And we have at least two people who declared that their supervisors told them they were going to lose their jobs. And so if you have that situation, the buyout is discriminatory because the person is choosing the buyout because he has been told he's going to lose his job. And that's exactly the situation we had in Adams. And just before I stop, I'd like to talk about the Schmidt case, if Your Honors will indulge me for a second.
Quickly, your time is more than up. So,
The Schmidt case was a riff in NASA. It was a situation where there was a trainee program for younger engineers. And what the Schmidt case held, what this circuit held, is that you count the people who are targeted. You count the people who were on the given notice of RIF, and you don't count only the 39 people who lose their jobs, but you count the 70 people who were told they were going to lose their jobs. The court below distinguished that because there were actual RIF notices in that case. Here what we had is a chart that said you're going to lose your job, and we're going to give you a RIF notice next summer. I don't see a legal distinction there in terms of the intent. The intent was to tell the people they're going to lose their job, and if they don't take this buyout, they're out.
Your time is more than up. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for a
Thank moment. You, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the appellee. As you're approaching, I will note that you also use the signal plus seam, and this is not just a matter of preference. Our rules specifically prohibit the use of that in the description of the contents of the brief. It's at page 41 of the handbook. Come ahead.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Okay. And both of counsel. Justice Black, I'm told, used to call them possums when people would use that in the Supreme Court. But both of counsel put possums in their briefs. So we do expressly prohibit that. It does make it very difficult to find.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Finding a possum is not hard either. Finding a possum is not easy either.
Go ahead, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Barbara Starschick, and I represent the FDIC. I'd like to make a few points today. One is that the district court properly held that FDIC employees who took the agency-wide buyout were properly excluded from the statistical age analysis when it came time to determine whether the RIF was age discriminatory. This was a buyout that was offered to, excuse me, to all employees throughout the agency. It wasn't just older employees. The employees had 5 months to make their decision whether to elect it. It wasn't a situation where on a Friday they were told, you got till Monday to decide. The employees were given a great deal of information. They were not pressured to take the buyout. There was no evidence of fraud or other misconduct by the FDIC. No one was threatened with harsh treatment if they didn't take the buyout. And consequently, many DRR employees chose not to take the buyout. This was not a situation where work was so intolerable that the employee's only choice was to take the buyout. I'd also like to correct an impression that was given by opposing counsel a few moments ago when he said that people were told, you will lose your job. That's not what happened. The agency, the employees in DRR were told, because the FDIC was trying to give them as much information as possible, this is the size of the reduction that we're going to have. There will be other opportunities for everyone. There will be the buyout, or you could go in through the crossover program or other ways to other divisions, which 73 employees in DRR chose to do.
I thought from the get-go they said, but it may be necessary or maybe probably be necessary to RIF some employees.
They said from the get-go, it will probably be necessary. We can't tell you that these voluntary transfers or voluntary buyouts are going to do the job. But it was not that one in two employees would be RIFed, and it was not that anyone knew that they would lose their job. And in the end, the RIFed employees, the 63 employees who got RIF notices and either were involuntarily separated or chose to resign or retire in lieu of involuntary separation, that's 12% of the population that had been at DRR. So it's not as if there was a one in two chance. And it's not as if everyone knew that they were going to lose their job. Under the plaintiff's view of buyouts, If a buyout is not followed by a RIF because enough employees have voluntarily left, and that happened in other divisions of the FDIC, and it happens in other federal agencies and corporations, the buyout would be discriminatory based on age. If the people taking the buyout are disproportionately older, and that can't be the law, that the buyout itself is going to be discriminatory. I'd also like to turn for a moment to...
But the claim here is, as I understand it, that the group targeted for reduction, whether through buyout or resignation or RIF, was disproportionately older. That this division had, I think, 7 years on average older employees than the next, than the agency as a whole, I mean.
Yes, Your Honor, the claim is that a group was targeted. There was
well,
no
the division
targeting.
Was targeted, to, for the, one thing.
I would not use the word targeting. There was a group that had declining business, and yes, the decision was made, whether you use targeted or not, the decision was made to reduce that group in size.
All right, we could just say sack the redundant employees to make it sound more British. What's the difference?
One difference is that the average age of the RIFT employees in DRR is 48 years old, 48.28. So we're not talking...
Of those who were RIFT.
Of those who were RIFT. Those who were RIFT. There were older employees who took the buyout, and that's common. And there were older employees throughout other parts of the agency taking voluntary buyouts, so that, for example, in the division DSC, which is the bank examining division, there was no threat of a RIF as to that division. They'd been told there would be no RIF. Over 100 employees took the buyout. We were offering the buyout agency-wide to try to be as generous and as humane as possible. And consequently, we wanted to be able to reduce the numbers that had to be involuntarily separated.
Well, were you offering the buyout outside of DRR and reducing the number of employees in those other divisions so as to create vacancies to which DRR redundant employees could be transferred?
I believe that was part of it, Your Honor.
From what I understood from your colleague a few moments ago, that option of transfer was not readily available.
No, Your Honor. And on Joint Appendix 101, the district court decision says that 73 DRR employees transferred to other divisions. Mm-hmm. Many of those transferred through a program that was known as the crossover program. And there were others. What was going on at the FDIC, at the same time that we knew we needed to reduce staff and we knew we needed to downsize because of the decline in business, something else that was going on was that a business decision had been made by the top FDIC management to try to reduce what we call our stovepipe way of doing business, where people are trained either as bank examiners or to handle bank failures, and they lack the cross-fertilization that management thought was necessary. So part of devising the crossover program and the CEP was a desire to break down that stovepipe mentality and create a group of employees who could cross-fertilize and switch skills from one area to the other as needed. That was done, and we gave a lot of opportunities to DRR employees to go through, to either be in CEP, to take the crossover program, or to take the buyout in an effort as humanely and generously as possible to reduce the numbers that had to be involuntarily separated. If I could speak to some of the other points for a moment, Your Honor, on the Teamsters pattern or practice issue, that was not preserved because it was not properly asserted in the district court. It wasn't...
Not properly what? I didn't...
I'm sorry. It wasn't properly asserted in the district court. It was not mentioned in the motion for reconsideration. Adams, the Adams case, might have been cited on a passing basis, but it was not cited for any purpose having to do with pattern or practice. I've looked through their citations to Adams as well as their citations to these other pattern or practice cases. And for example, in that brief for which they cited Adams repeatedly, on page 25, for example, they cited it for the proposition that an employee who takes a voluntary severance is not acting voluntarily. They cited it for a lot of propositions, but not for pattern or practice. And that's with all the other cases, too. They might have used the word pattern or practice, the phrase pattern or practice, once as a snippet, but not in any way that brought to their opponent's attention or the court's attention that pattern or practice was being asserted in this case. I'd like to talk for a moment, if I might, about Chairman Powell's statements. The district court correctly held that there was no evidence that he had made those statements and that the statements were made only by plaintiff's counsel. In addition, even if they had been made, they were too remote in time and they were benign, and there is no support for them to be used to support plaintiff's case. The Schmidt case, plaintiff's reliance is misplaced because that was limited, those statistics were limited to people who received RIF notices. That's the same thing we're asking for here. If this court has no further questions, I will conclude.
Seeing none, we'll give 2 minutes back to appellant for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Rose.
Thank you for the time, Your Honor. Page 22 of the joint appendix is the paragraph 85 of our original complaint. It says that in designing and implementing the 2004 and 2005.
The joint appendix is the first page.
I'm sorry. JA 43, it's page 22 of the complaint.
I can understand your confusion.
Paragraph 85 of the complaint says pattern of practice of purposeful discrimination against the plaintiffs. It was certainly alleged in the complaint.
I can understand that to be necessary. As I said when you were up on direct, I'm not sure that is sufficient. If you alleged something and then never referred to it again, I'm not sure that you preserved it. Is there anything in the contest of the summary judgment motions or anywhere else that would show us that you preserved that claim? You'd have to agree, I think, counsel, that it isn't that uncommon to allege things in your complaint that never get heard at trial. Maybe whole counts of complaints.
If you look at the supplemental appendix, page 73, the introduction to the plaintiff's summary judgment brief, you'll see also the pattern of practice appears on that page.
Page 73 of the SA?
Yes.
Okay. Where am I looking now?
The last sentence says, no more need to be shown to make a prima facie case of a pattern of practice of discrimination, citing Palmer versus Schultz out of this circuit. Palmer is, of course, a pattern of practice case. It was mentioned in the briefs. It certainly wasn't emphasized, but the evidence is the same evidence that we put in on the district court. It's the same report. It's the same statistics. We talk about Hazelwood and Palmer on page 102. On page 168 of the joint appendix, we talk about Adams in the It's Palmer, Adams, Hazelwood, all to show the statistical analysis. Now, we were a little sloppy with that language there. We did. It's the same adverse impact, whether it's used to show unintentional discrimination or whether it's used to show intentional discrimination. And the point about pattern of practice isn't so much the intentional versus the unintentional as it is the class question versus the individual question. One reason we weren't so careful about that in the briefing before the district court is because this was a bifurcated case that was coming up on summary judgment. We assumed that the class issue would be decided first. We only briefed the class issue. We didn't brief the individual issues of constructive discharge that the court below used to exclude the people who took the buyout from the analysis. Because we were never challenging just the RIF notices. We were challenging the notice that people are going to lose their jobs.
Your time again has expired, so unless my colleagues have further questions. I want to address both of counsel. You can have your seat if you like. And something beyond the PASEM, which is a violation of our local rules, but the federal rules of appellate procedure are something that have perhaps a greater importance. Both of you represent the kind of clientele that might make you repeat players. The joint appendix under 30D, which lays out the requirements of the joint appendix in the rules of appellate procedure, says the appendix must begin with a table of contents identifying the page at which each part begins. Now, the table of contents in this joint appendix is an ordered list, and it has what order the documents are. It does not give the page at which the document begins, and it's deucedly hard to find anything. It's like being in the Library of Congress without a card index or the computerized equivalent thereof. It's awfully hard to find these when you don't comply with the rules. So you are both likely to be repeat players in appellate court, and please go by the rules. There are reasons for these rules, and the reasons in this case have made themselves evident. I realize that appellant is responsible for the appendix in the first instance, but appellee failed to call that to the attention of anyone, the error in the appendix. So. That's no point in it now, counsel. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Give us recess.